When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to Bingetown TV. My name is Jim, and I'm joined by my co-hosts Paul and Luke. And today we continue our coverage of Hulu and FX's hit TV series Shogun. Today we cover episode 7, titled A Stick of Time. We're getting closer and closer to the finish line every single week, and we just want to thank all of you who've stuck with us throughout this season, especially our friends who have hit us up on Discord and our socials. We've been having an absolute blast covering this season and interacting with all of you. If you're a fan of the pod, all we ask is you hit that subscribe button on our main Bingetown feed. And if you want to chat, we'd love to have you as a member of our Discord community, link in the description. And if you're new to the pod, welcome. We're excited to have you, and we hope you enjoy our coverage and stick with us for the rest of the season and the other shows we cover. All right, guys, Shogun episode 7, titled A Stick of Time. I'm back. I'm very sad that I missed you guys last week, but you killed it. I really enjoyed your coverage because I edited the video, so I got to listen to the whole thing. I had a blast listening to you guys. I thought you covered a lot of good stuff. Let's hear what you guys thought first. Let's start the discussion that way, and then we can go from there.
Yeah, so A Stick of Time, episode 7. This was probably the most negative I felt leaving an episode. And I know, Jimmy, me and you were talking on the side. You're probably closer aligned to me than maybe the general public. I don't really know. I haven't done a lot of internet searching yet on what people are saying about this episode, but I really thought that it did not feel good as a 7 out of 10 series like episode. Like, it just felt like it was like a slow moving episode again. Like, this combined with the last one, it really makes you kind of in hindsight look like the plot's been halted. Like, we haven't been spending a lot of time moving the plot at the pace that we did through the first 5 episodes. And I was totally comfortable with slowing down, working on their characters for episode 6. But now that it's happened twice in a row, and I actually think this episode, even with the quote-unquote character work it did, I felt like a lot of the character interactions fell flat. They didn't progress anything. I was almost confused at what the takeaways for some of the interactions are. I don't want to spoil some of those thoughts until we get there. It's still above quality, above average quality and just normal TV, but I really felt like this was the first episode where I wasn't too happy with it. And I don't want to get into more specifics yet, but Paul, since I haven't even heard what your opinion on episode 7 was, what did you think?
I mean, I liked it a lot. I think I appreciated it more on the second watch through. I kind of understand that feeling that you have of negativity, but I also really enjoyed it. And I feel like there's some behind the scenes things where once we finish the season, we could look back at this episode and be like, wow, like, they were trying to trick us. There were some secrets being held, like, without going too far into it. Torinaga might be scheming everybody. And
yeah,
I mean, we'll obviously discuss more, but like, Gin gets into it when they have their Stick of Time, which titled the episode. So obviously that was a huge scene. Yeah, I don't know. I really love it. I will say the end, both times watching the end happen, and I'm like, really? Damn, man, that's so weird how that worked out. So obviously emotions everywhere because so much did happen all in like 1 second. So overall, I do love this episode.
And let me add a comment onto my reaction based on what you just said there about Torinaga. A huge part of my disappointment was how it felt like everything we've known about him and seen up to this point, he's been this strategic genius. Everything goes his way. When he's quiet for a reason. When he has a conversation, it's for a reason. And it felt like that all went out the window this episode. And I think there's a lot of room for them to fix it. So like in the next episode, they can completely change my opinion looking back. But right now, like, I didn't think I took anything from that Lady Jin conversation. I thought the Mariko and Buntaro stuff took up way too much time to have pretty much no movement forward in their relationship. And Nagakato, like, he's been pretty much the worst character since the first time he's been introduced. And I feel like that just kind of stuck with it. Just a bunch of my just negative opinions coming out, because I'm gonna still be hyping up the episode as we're going through it. So I just want Like, basically, this is the only time I've been able to talk about Shogun in a slightly negative light, so I'm just going to ride with it because it's never going to happen again. I'm pretty confident we're going to bounce back in episode 8, but I need to point it out when I am disappointed a little bit, just a little bit.
Yeah, I feel you there. I feel out both of you guys, actually, because let me first say my thoughts on the last episode, and I'm going to keep this quick, and I'll pepper it in. I'll pepper it in throughout the episode. I think it'll make sense to start with what I feel about episode 6 because it'll give you a reason why I was upset a little bit about 7. So I think one of the best parts about episode 6 was getting our background and the connection to between Mariko and Oshiba, right? Mm-hmm. That was phenomenal. Figuring out their backstory, getting more about Mariko and having her conversation with Torunaga. That was so good to me. And I'm not going to go too much in episode 6 other than that, just because for now, I'm upset about Mariko in this episode. I think that they put her on the back burner. And I think that, to be honest, I don't understand why she still has the I don't want to be alive mentality after that great conversation with Torunaga. I thought that that conversation's point was to let her know that she has a purpose. So I feel like that conversation with Torunaga came out of nowhere almost, meaning the conversation with her saying, please take my life or let me take my own life.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something that bothered me.
Just like regression for her as a character, right?
I just like, to your point, Luke, you're saying that episode 7 in an entire series, not season 1, episode 7, where we have 8 seasons coming, right?
Mm-hmm.
Episode 7 is deep into a single series. I mean, there is 3 hours left. 3 hours, a lot can happen. But I didn't expect us to get that push, that purpose for Mariko in episode 6. That really got me going, really got me excited. And then in episode 7, really, really just put her on the back burner and then regress her a little bit. I'm sure they'll figure it out, and I'm sure she'll come right back into the limelight, into the front lines in episode 8, 9, 10, or whatever. But for now, it's just a little confusing.
Yeah, you put that better than I did. That's just how I felt. And then JB might as well have not even been in this episode. He had a really funny moment, like one of the funniest of the entire show, which he always does. But like, he didn't get a lot of development either. I don't know. I think it'll all come out. Maybe, and usually when we go through these podcasts, anything I feel slightly negative about, we talk it out and I feel better. So maybe that'll be the case here.
The only thing I wanted to say about episode 7 additionally was that I said I saw both of your points because, Paul, no matter what, I really, and your point is this as well, Luke, I really enjoy these episodes. And I don't know if this is my least favorite. I think it's the one that I see the most problems with in my own head of things that I didn't really like. I'm not saying logically, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking it after episode 8, 9, and 10, Paul, you might be right, and you probably will be right, and we'll be like damn, that was freaking sweet, because I really don't expect Torunaga to have been bested like that, because that is so out of character. Luke, you already talked about it, and we'll talk about it more later, but that was another big struggle I had with this episode. I didn't understand how Torunaga got bested, and then Jin herself called him out for it and was like, you have a plan, right? Because this is bullshit, basically. So talk about it. But yeah, there are some things, and those things might easily get fixed. So it'll be something interesting to talk about in the later episodes.
Anything else, Paul, before we jump in?
No, just, I think it'll be a good discussion that we'll have, because I already got some things lined up, and I think we always talk me off the ledge.
That's all I'm saying.
We always reflect more at the end of the discussion. So I get what you're saying, though, because I will say last episode, Crimson Sky with the hi-hi-ho, I was ready to go. Yeah, I thought that was the alley-oop, and we were going to dunk on episode 7. But without anything else, yeah, let's just jump in to this crazy
hi-hi-ho, ready to go, dude.
So littered throughout episode 7 were those flashback scenes. We get the initial right off the bat, and then we get a couple down the road. So let's lump it all together, just talk through it real quick. The flashback takes place 46 years ago, and we find out that Torunaga at this time, he was in his first ever battle and his first victory, because he's never lost, and that he was 12 years old. So that tells us that he's 58 now, which is interesting. I don't know how old I really in the back of my head thought he was, but it's so funny to see a young little Torunaga and Hiromatsu just at this battle, which he's the man. He's been there since day one for him. But let us talk through this entire interaction, because what it is Torunaga winning the battle and going to see the other opposing side leader, Mizoguchi, who surrenders and actually honors Torinaga and is very not excited, but he's very honored to have been defeated by this young warlord, is what he calls him. And then the reveal later on is that the legend of this moment wasn't as pretty as it was really painted out to be. And it, when Torinaga went to execute the other opposing guy, it took him 9 swings instead of 1, but he was freaking in 6th grade, 12 years old. Like, how do you even play?
Right?
Yeah, it really shows you the horrors that he's been through. We already knew about the hostage situation, even though we get a little bit more detail on that later on. But like, to do this, to be called upon to be this dude's second, first of all, to witness him commit seppuku is just crazy. And then to have to be his second is nuts. He probably didn't do anything. He was probably just on the horse the whole battle. But, you know, maybe he was giving commands.
Our boy did something, dude.
But that was probably like his first kill. That's a huge assumption.
So true, because knowing Torinaga and knowing how the story goes in real life and him talking about, you know, myths and stories versus actual facts, he's 12. I don't care if you're the biggest badass in the world. If you're 12, you're going to be shitting your pants, kind of like his brother said, when he's in the middle of this huge battle. Whether you're on the horse, whether you're on the ground swinging the sword, either way, it's going to be scary as hell for a 12-year-old.
Yeah, the only other thing from the scene that I noted was that Mizoguchi, one of these surrenderings, references fate again. He says it was fate that led him to start this unwinnable war. And they just constantly refer to fate a lot this episode. So it's just something to highlight, is that is such a big view on life, is like, you just have fate. Like, it's you don't have any control. It's just fate. Meanwhile, you got like Lady Ochiba, who's like, fuck fate, dude. I just grab it by the face. So it's interesting how they view it, though, as like an object or something like out there. It's interesting.
And another important theme it's like tropey in a way, where history is written by the winners kind of thing. And that gets reemphasized here, that Torinaga, it's not as pretty of a picture as the story's being told. So we get to see that here, which maybe he didn't have all these clean victories in his past. And maybe they're trying to plant the seed that some of his feats are a little overemphasized. But I hate to go that way. That seems like the opposite of what I want to do.
Yeah, I just think this more emphasizes the fact that Torinaga doesn't need anything to be glorified. He doesn't want anything to be glorified. It's a great parallel to his son, Nagakato, who just wants this huge myth story to happen. He wants to be in the storybooks because he hasn't had his first real battle, even though technically, I mean, he's had a fight. We saw that. That was the season. But I guess he means like battle. You know, he wants to be like his dad, and he glorifies all this stuff. And the point is, and Torinaga says it himself, the only people that want to jump into these battles are the people that have never done it before. It sucks. It's not anything good. You make it through. You live. That's your reward. And everyone always glorifies it when really you're like, the thing freaking sucked. You know, going back to what you said, Paul, I believe it was in the last episode with Sugiyama's death and the CGI for that. The show started off so hot with the CGI for this battle, with the head being chopped off, and like, and then even obviously the seppuku with them actually showing like the guts starting to come out when he stabbed himself. It really started off great, I thought, this episode.
Yeah. And honestly, I think the vibes continued, and I got completely tricked, spoiler, on Saiki. Saiki Dono is what he usually says, is with the honorific. Sound right? S-A-E-K-I is where I'm going with Saiki.
Saiki sounds fine to me, and we'll... One of our listeners gave us a great couple of translations, and I'm not, you guys do so well, and I just keep butchering it, but we thank you for hitting us up on Instagram and letting us know, and you can definitely let us know about the brother's name as well after this episode.
Yeah, we're East Coast boys. We got some bad accents over here.
But I'm the worst of all you guys.
Anyway, Torinaga in modern day now is meeting the envoy of his half-brother. I think they clarified half-brother in the last episode, Saiki, who has the coolest looking armor. I love all of the white look that they roll up in. And the couple things we could just talk about right away is the whole political advisors of Tornaga are there, like his son, Hiramatsu, JB's even there, and he gets called up and meets Psyche for a second, which is a funny moment because this guy is super charming. He's cocky. Yeah, I love everything about him. I wanted to like him, and I was convincing myself that he was going to be good, but it felt like things were starting to be too good to be true. But I don't know. What was your guys' initial reaction for his introduction when he's messing with Torinaga about, like, look at your shitty army, all this stuff, and then he's cracking jokes?
I'm trying not to be like 14-year-old view on things, but I'm like, dude, penis helmet, like 100%. Like, I don't know, man. If anybody watches South Park out there, when Cartman goes in the future and like there's scientists fighting the other scientists and they have the weird shit on their head, that's what it reminded me of. So it was kind of hard to like take him seriously sometimes when that was in the back of my head. But totally exactly what you were saying, Luke. I found myself liking him. I was like, oh, he's a little charismatic, like he's very in this area where everybody's kind of soft-spoken because you don't want to insult everybody. He's like loud and out there, so I thought he was going to be an actual bro. But exactly 100% what you said about the armor, that like gray silver look, that would be it looks so clean.
I was about to text you guys and say this guy's the man in the beginning, and I literally was like putting my fingers out to text, and then I was like, there's still 45 minutes in this episode.
Yeah.
I just saw this guy, like you said, you guys nailed it. Charismatic, good looking dude, looks like a badass. He's talking back and forth with our boy Torinaga, where he's not scared of him. He's laughing. He's funny. He's saying, let's go get drunk. I was like, this guy's a beast, man. This is our man. And I guess, I don't know, should we have seen it coming? Just because it is funny that they were so worried about this guy. Where they were so worried what it was going to be like with the brother showing up. And then he was literally just like, for a second, messing with him, acting like he was all like stern. And then he was like, ah, I got you, my boy. And I was like, oh, man, I didn't even think. I was just like, man, I want to love this guy. I'm not even going to think about him turning on us. But it probably should have been seen by us just by what everyone was thinking or talking and saying about him.
So I was thinking that they didn't really give us a whole lot. I mean, we just kind of really learned about him the end of last episode, so we didn't really have enough time to theorize on him. I didn't even know that, like, I didn't even think Ishida or Lady Chiba even knew that Saiki existed. He said he looks over Yuzenji, so I'm not exactly sure where that is.
Yeah, that must not get any action at all, because he's saying
the still waters. But I have a question for you guys that kind of goes along with that. So he has a line where he's like, hey, I spied a decimated army on my way here. Like, was that you? And he was like, yeah, the earthquake hit us pretty bad. Do you think that Saiki had his mind made up, or do you think he was on the fence and then saw the decimated army and was like, oh, I don't have a chance?
He was already a councilman.
You can do whatever you want. I think what you were about to just say is you can tell them I'm on the council. And then if you think Torinaga is going to win, you can just say, hey, I'm on Torinaga's side, just pretty much like Yabu would do, or Torinaga pretty much did himself, where he was a council member and then a regent. And then he had to roll out because he doesn't believe in what they're doing. So technically, I guess you can do whatever the hell you want. You just better hope that your side wins. Mm-hmm. But the problem that you end up seeing with Saiki is, of all these characters that we meet, whether they're good, bad, gray, we usually see that most of them are honorable. And that's what they really, really put emphasis on. But Saiki obviously is not, because he fully bullshitted Torinaga here, was already a regent, played him like a fiddle, and then turned the tables on him. You know, those things obviously happen in war, but your brother, bro.
Mm-hmm.
He's supposed to be a little bit more honorable than that. And going back to him really quick, I was expecting when they first started explaining him, like, make sure you bow and don't say anything, make sure the engine doesn't say anything, blah, 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 blah. I was expecting, like, for all of our listeners who love our comparisons, a Stannis comparison. Like, I thought Stannis, like, more like stern. I don't know. I guess I shouldn't have thought that, because that's almost like Torinaga, where he's very just like, you know, stern, non-emotional. But I was expecting someone like that, because it made it seem like if you step out of line for a second, he's going to change his mind. He's not going to come with us and work, you know, and work with the army.
Yeah, he could have been more of the erratic type, like the wild, like centric. But I don't know. They could have gone anyway. And I like the way that they went. But like you're saying, Paul, they didn't plant the seed early enough for us to have time to think that this could happen. Like, it just happened. He comes and 15 minutes of screen time later, he betrays us. So it's like, it was like a political Game of Thrones moment, but the payoff wasn't really like built up to be a super satisfying scene, is just how I took it.
Yeah. And
it was still fun at face value, but again, like, the him getting decimated by the earthquake, then his brother betrays him, seems like overkill, because I was already in the opinion that we are fighting the biggest uphill battle before, even if he decided to join his army, which is what they kind of said in episode 6. But so let's keep going here. A lot of things happen after Psyche shows up and he starts to get comfortable before their dinner scene that night. And what we have is quick mention of Torunaga buying Kiku again, this time for a week for his brother to entertain him. That's going to have more conversation in the later scenes. But we also get to see JB have one of his longer scenes of the episode. And he is the same freaking character over and over about his ship and his boys. He just wants to get the hell out of there. Like, I know that was a fear early on for me, but like, he totally is just so done with Japan. Like, now Mariko's kind of distancing herself from him. Like, he has no reason to like stay here. And he mentions, like, you're giving me all these gifts, but like, what am I doing here? Like, you're not giving me any roles. I'm just kind of being your show boy, is what it is. Yeah. The kind of vibe that I got. So what else did you guys think about that scene?
Totally agree that, like, he's almost been stuck at this point. Like, ever since he got like his first gift and title, he hasn't really done anything besides be there and just kind of be an image almost. And John does go and like save him. And obviously that's why he gets more titles and gifts bestowed upon him. But I feel like he's been stuck since like episode like 4 or 5. Like, he hasn't really done anything. And I know he's getting frustrated by it too. So it's wild that Torunaga this whole time just has not given him anything about any information about his ship, when he can have it, what he controls, what even happened with his men. So I can definitely see why he's getting so frustrated.
Torunaga owes JB some explanation, because this is like the fourth time he saved his life. Torunaga said twice, which I think that's undercounting, but it's time to start giving him some more information here. That's what I think.
I was expecting by now for them to be homies, and they're not. You know, they're fine. Meaning Torunaga respects him enough, but they're not friends. They're not friendly. This is another episode where Tornaga's like, I'm not speaking about this, and pretty much turns his back to JB. We thought that when he saved him from the earthquake, that was going to be the turning point, and it really wasn't. Yes, he got all these gifts and blah, 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 but back to my point from episode like 3 or something, maybe 4, he's a prisoner. That's who he is. He has a use. To Torunaga.
Yeah.
And Torunaga's just going to use him. I still have hopes. I do think they're going to be homies. I can't imagine it doesn't go any other way. Come on. But I thought it would have been by now. And yeah, we'll get into it more once we get a couple more scenes with JB and Torunaga.
The last line was promising. John says, tell him I'm ready for whatever our fate may bring. This was another fate reference, but like, he was like, hey, I don't know if that was just a show to try and get on Torunaga's good side, but I don't know. It seems like there's a little something there.
It's just like the last thing on his mind, I guess. I'm trying to play devil's advocate for Torunaga. Like, he has so much other shit going on. But still, this guy saves your life every freaking day. So it's like, give him something, throw him a bone.
Yeah, I mean, JB, he says, all right, let me leave. No? Okay, fine. Then let me do something for you. No? Then what the hell am I doing at all? Like, I mean, that is where he's at right now, and I totally get it. I get the frustration.
Yeah. It's even boring. I'm not boring, but it's frustrating as an audience member as well. So exactly. We're right there with JB. But these next couple of scenes are just quick hitters again. Like, we're still kind of in the setup of this episode where we see the tea house. And we see Omi go by, and he's still all in on Kiku, or at least he wants to talk to her about something, but he is completely done with that lifestyle now, because JB, not the lifestyle, the actual tea house itself, he just hates John so much that like whatever he touches, he considers soiled. So the weirder part of that conversation was, why was Lady Jin so willing to just give up that information that JB wasn't actually interested in Kiku, and hinting at the idea about him looking at Mariko, which plays into him pushing Buntaro later. All of that felt like it was so much screen time for almost no notable payoff.
Yeah, no immediate payoff, at least. And it's weird because when they have this conversation, meaning Omi and Gin, they don't really show anything else besides her saying that. But like, he could have gone in, maybe she was inviting him in and they discussed it more. And maybe there was motivation behind that, because like, Omi doesn't really talk to Buntaro and like say anything about it. He kind of talks to him a little bit, but it's more just like, like your wife just does her duty very well. And like, I don't know if he's like playing.
He's stirring the pot, dude.
Yeah, he's trying to do it, I guess. I don't know what he's doing.
I'll tell you what he's doing. He hates JB. He wants Buntaro to kill him. You know,
yeah.
He doesn't want JB around. But I would say that.
Oh, yeah.
Are we going to go with Jin or Gin? You guys talked about this last week, and I can't remember.
I think we split. I thought one of them said Gin. That's why I've been saying it like that.
Lady G.
Yeah.
Lady G is totally the thing now. Who was Big Papa last week?
It's that father. It's the other father. Yeah.
Martine's homie. My thoughts with Lady G, when you look at it, it doesn't make sense with the overall storyline that we've seen so far with her, because if she tells Omi that kind of stuff about JB, that goes from Omi to Buntaro, which then goes from Buntaro maybe killing JB, which is not good for Torunaga. Any of that strife in his camp is not good. So she goes to him later and she wants his help and wants to be on his side. So that really doesn't seem to make any sense. The only thing I can think of is going back more towards her conversation that she has later during her stick of time, when she says, you know, I was nothing and I built myself up. What she has to build herself up at this point in her life and what her currency, quote unquote, is the little whispers. You know, that's her currency. She has gossip. She has facts. Yeah. She has things that she can use on people, right? So when she's talking to Omi, he's pissed. He doesn't want to come in, but he wants Kiku. And he's not going to take, oh, hey, here's a couple bucks. Get out of my face. But if she says like, oh, you know, JB, you know, he wasn't really looking at Kiku. He was looking at someone else. That might be enough for him to be like, oh, I feel you. And then he walks out and he has a little bit of something to walk away from.
Or she gets something out of him, like in their conversation.
Right.
Like, while he's mad and frustrated, he lets something slip and she gets information that way. So she, for being introduced last episode, was it two episodes ago? Mama G, whatever you want to call her, Lady G. She is a great character. Love having her on screen, honestly.
Yeah, I agree.
So yeah, I have more to say on her, but I want to wait until her conversation with Torunaga. So
yeah,
we do have that another quick scene where Hiramatsu visits his favorite granddaughter Fuji, and just like Monaco later in this episode, these girls are just so ready to kill themselves at the drop of a freaking dime. She's hyped. She's like, oh, thank you for, he delivers the ashes of her, I'm assuming her husband and her child from Osaka, like after that whole execution happened. And that's great. And she's like excited. She's like, it's a memorable item for her. And then she's like, oh yeah, as soon as this battle's over, like I'll get to kill myself and be with them. It just like, what the hell, man?
Yeah,
I do love Fuji, but this scene, like, I don't know. I don't have any other comments besides wow.
I thought she was kind of getting a little bit more reason to live. Like, she was actually kind of warming up being around Mariko and JB and being the head of the house and everything. But yeah, when this happened and she says this, I was like, nope, she's like back to square one. Maybe she just doesn't have a purpose. She doesn't have a fight, or she doesn't have a feel like she has a reason to live or something. But yeah, like it's just insane to me how they just casually drop. Yep. And when this is done, I can't wait to end it.
That mindset.
Yeah. I mean, who are we to tell them about their culture and their honor? But we freaking love these characters and we don't want them to be thinking that. It has, obviously, we know based on these characters that this is just how it is, and they feel like without their husband and son, or Mariko without her father, whatever their purpose was supposed to be, without that, what's the point, right? Fine, but we love them, so we want them to live, and we want them, and we'll get to Mariko in a little bit, because that is just so frustrating. Fuji's frustrating as well, but Mariko's even more frustrating, because I really thought she went over the hill on that topic and was ready to just do the damn thing and be Team Torunaga and fulfill her purpose to what her father thought her purpose was, what she thinks her purpose is, all that stuff. But we have two of our favorite characters. They don't want to be friends with us anymore. They just want to leave us.
So here's a question then. Is there any world where we get a happy ending and Torinaga ends up becoming Shogun? Like we win the war and then they're like, yes, we win. And then both Mariko and Fuji, like either or actually like gets their version of their own happy ending, or are they both going to find purpose in the next three episodes that they didn't find over the first seven? Because you bring it up, Jimmy, and the more you say it, the more I'm like, yeah, like we spent all this work to build Mariko up to having that purpose. We're introducing John, building that relationship, showing her there's more to this world than just these rituals. What's going to change now that hasn't happened in the first 7 hours of this show that's going to be believable at this point? Because right now, I mean, they're both ready to go at the moment's notice.
Yeah, I think it's going to be Mariko stays alive because she and John become a thing, and that's her purpose. But Fuji is going to have a happy ending where she survives this whole scenario. But then going back to what you said about shock value of like the culture and not being used to how this culture is, her happy ending is probably going to be what makes us sad.
And I think that's good writing, is to do it that way. Otherwise, what's the point of like reinforcing this constantly if they're not going to go through it? And I don't mean that in like a cynical, psychotic way. Like if the writers are going to do this and make this part of their characters in every single episode, I think they need to follow through.
Right.
Unless JB is the catalyst that changes all of Japan. And it's like a magical, you know, like I don't buy that. Let's get to the meat and potatoes of this episode. Because this is the turning point. This is the dinner. And that seems to be a common theme that Shogun loves to make the dinner scenes freaking the best. Because this scene starts off, vibes are up, we're drinking, everybody's there. We have both armies' heads there. Everybody that's a council member or advisor to either of the brothers is in attendance. They have their sake poured, they're eating fish, all this stuff. And they start off with talking about stories, and Nagakato's asking about his dad when he was younger. Of course, he wants to hear these from a different perspective. Torinaga's always got his mouth shut, so he's never blabbing about his historic moments. And it starts off fun, and everybody's laughing, and it just quickly turns when Saiki starts bringing up a dishonorable story that makes Torinaga look bad. And then it just starts escalating to the point where he just flips, and everybody in his army just blocks off any route, any escape, and he has complete control over the entire area and goes on to deliver two summons. The first being Torinaga needs to go to Ishido to pay for his punishment, which that we saw that coming from a mile away once they said that he's on Ishido's side, because he admits that he is the newest councilman on the whole regent squad there. That's something that's going to be fun to talk about. And then the second part of it was Nagakado almost takes his punishment of basically also having to be put to death because of his killing of Jozen. So a lot goes down in this quick little scene, but this was the first one where I just like the entire vibe of the episode shifted.
It was pretty nuts. They're talking and all of a sudden the story about him shitting himself and riding on the horse, and he always felt for that horse, and he has the cup of sake up, but nobody's cheersing with him. Then everything gets tense.
Your pin drop.
Then he's like, all right, so what should I get if I participate in this Crimson Sky? Should I become the ruler of Izu? And Yabu looks up like, what'd you say? And then, out comes a scroll. Doesn't even hand it to Hiramatsu. He throws it to him. And that's just an insult on top of everything else going on. Hiramatsu does a double take. Like, what did you just do? Yeah, the reaction from Torinaga when Nagakata reaches out. Do not accept it. That was tense.
I can't imagine that Torinaga doesn't know his own brother. I understand that Hiramatsu said they hadn't seen each other in too long. We don't know really anything about this brother and the relationship. Did they grow up together? Is he looks younger? Is he a half brother that they didn't even really grow up together? I mean, he has the story about Torinaga being taken as a hostage when he's young, so he must have been around for some stuff. So my thoughts are, I'm going to be really upset if Torinaga didn't know this was coming, whether it was, hey, my brother's probably going to sandbag me, and also, let me just put some scouts out to see if any enemy troops are coming. I just can't see what the point is, though. Like, I don't know what his plan could be. He could bring himself to Osaka to surrender himself. If that's part of the plan, he doesn't need Saiki to do it. I can't figure it out. but I really hope that there is some kind of explanation, because the fact that we have everybody like whispering about Psyche, and then he fakes us out and he's like, I'm your homie, I'm your friend, we're bros, like, let's get drunk together. And then, like, to us on screen, immediately, he just changes right back to, I'm the antagonist and I'm going to talk some shit. It just seems like this should have been a thing that was Toranaga knew was coming. And that's one of my big problems with this whole episode.
Right. And is it, I guess that kind of links back to what I was saying before. Like, are we overestimating Toranaga's abilities, or is this just going to be a great reveal that happens as soon as he gets to Osaka next episode? And then we're all back here freaking winding it up again. And nobody cares about anything. And then we're all good. I am worried, though, that there wasn't enough there. Like you're saying, we couldn't have guessed it. Like, what was there? What plans was there? What other allies have been mentioned that weren't physically there? I don't see the pathway, unless Lady G has something up her sleeve that conversation had a double meaning.
So if Lady G, who is not supposed to be Toranaga status when it comes to war, if she knew to say out loud, I can't believe you didn't have any scouts to make sure there was no enemy troops coming your way, what the hell's up with that? If she can think of that, then Toranaga definitely should, whether he is who we think he is or he might be glorified by stories. Mm-hmm. Whether they want to go one way or the other, I really do think he should have known that. And I think it's part of the plan. I just can't figure out what the plan is. Shout out to Lanson on our Discord. They were saying the same thing. Shocking thing, but they just can't figure out what the plan is. And we'll talk again more about Lady G in a little bit, but you know, he's not our friend, he's not our homie, but I do like Psyche. I like his character, I like who he is. He's the same guy that we met when I said, all right, here comes my phone, I'm gonna say he's one of our bros. Same guy, except he just isn't a bro, he's still the cool character.
Yeah,
I like
he really
him.
Is cool.
I like him. He's just a cool antagonist.
Any other comments, Paul?
I'll keep my comments more about Toranaga and how he reacts to this all more with that Lady G scene.
Okay, because the next direct thing we do see is JB hearing this news. He was there, but of course he didn't hear a single word that whole freaking time. Like, he was, and Mariko was not translating. So we do get that quick scene of them talking and her explaining what the real situation is. And he just instantly goes into escape mode, which I actually really liked, where he was thinking of a way how him and Mariko could escape. Maybe he was even lumping in Fuji if he cared enough about her. But she shuts that down because she's like, there's absolutely no way. And then the next direct thing is we see him seeing the Erasmus getting taken over by Ishido's flag. So his escape path is gone. I don't think that's an option anymore. Never really was, but nothing surprising there, right? Like, you guys didn't think Mariko was going to be like, let's get out of here, freaking five of them, you know, whatever.
That's the opposite of her character.
Yeah, that happens. And then a scene that I'm hopeful about, and I've been like a broken record about Yabu this entire season, going up and down. Do I like him? Do I not? Do I think he's going to join our team? Do I not? And I think this next scene might push me back onto the side where there's no choice. Like, Yabu gets confronted by Psyche and he gives him back the head of a general that he low-key sent to Shido to kind of explain the situation. Exactly, yeah. And to explain the situation away and make it so that Yabu was going to come out onto the council side. But that's gone. Like, he's like, you're going to die now, basically. And I just hope that Omi and Yabu can get the fuck over themselves and just decide that they need to be with Toranaga, because he just can't handle more chaos under his house. And that's really what we've been seeing, so.
Totally. For me, Yabu is 100% with Toranaga after this. I mean,
been saying that since the first episode.
Yeah. And Yabu's reaction to opening that was incredible. I mean, he didn't even say a single word, but he was like hesitant. He was like, I don't feel like doing and checking it. I already know what it's going to be. Then he checks it and he starts giggling. He's like, you son of a bitch. I'm gonna kill you so hard. Like, I just absolutely, as brutal as that scene was, I did like it a lot.
Agreed. He's got to be on our side now.
So now we're gonna move over to that night after this news is spread. Everybody knows the deal that Toranaga is no longer really in power here. And then I think this is where we're at. Lady G coming into have her a stick of time and the meeting where she's going to lay it all out. You find out about her backstory that Jimmy kind of covered already. She just wants her end goal to be that in Edo, She wants to build the Guild of Courtesans and essentially just have like a block all to themselves, which in modern day anime, I feel like you see that a lot. Demon Slayer, which has a specific season that takes place in one of these type of areas in a major city. But I didn't get enough out of this scene for me to be satisfied where I thought that Lady G was going to be part of the resolution. And maybe one of you guys has some sort of theory or idea of how she can play a part, because it's not like the courtesans are trained assassins. Like, they can't just like sneak in.
Yeah.
Maybe Kiku could be the exception, or some of the, like, if we find out that she's part of, Paul, what's it called? The Buddha clan.
Buddha Amida. Yeah.
Like, if she's part of that, like, maybe. Amoeba. But other than that, it just felt like Torinaga was being realistic and saying, I'm going to be dead very soon. Like, what can I do for you here? And yeah, that's pretty much my takeaway from the scene, which I felt like the writers were trying to speak to me more, but I couldn't get it. I don't know.
In my head, there's two things, I guess, that were like the point of that scene. My first take is that it's just her speaking to us besides Torinaga and kind of letting us know that it's so shocking that he is in this predicament and there must be a plan. I feel like her saying that is like letting us know that he's going to have a plan, but also letting us see his reaction to fake us out, where he's saying, you know, fate is what it is. My time is up. But then I also thought, okay, something's going to happen where she helps him. And I would have bet $1 million that Kiku was going to assassinate Seiko in that final scene. Okay. I was not expecting her to let Nagakado in. I was expecting her to say, I could do some more for your pleasure. Here's some more pleasure tools, and then just kill him. And then that was going to be the point of what Lady G was saying she could do for Torinaga.
Yeah.
Now that that didn't come to fruition, I don't think they can do that. So I don't think that's even a thing anymore. So my point now is, I just think maybe it was her saying, yeah, man, you should have had a plan. Like, how do you not have a plan? You're the great Torinaga.
Now, like a huge part of the early part of this podcast was talking about Kiku and if she was a spy for somebody in Osaka, could she have been Torinaga's spy? Is it kind of confirmed that she just was being sketchy and working as a spy for Lady G, who can use her in these weird ways? Because I don't think there's any answers that I have, but
information is the currency, and maybe Lady G uses Kiku to try to sway things the way she wants it, like how she was saying whatever she was saying, whispering in the ear of Omi and this and that in the earlier episodes. But I agree. So I thought she was going to be a spy. And I mean, how is she not dead after this episode? How is Kiku not going to die? I mean, unless she runs away, she literally let Nagakado in.
We're squishing those two scenes together. Oh, just to keep them separate for a second. What you're saying about there being more to the Willow World, 100% there probably is, because she opens this conversation with Torinaga with, like, do you know what it means to be a part of the Willow World? And then she goes in to describe everything that they give and the reasoning for her district that she wants. But I think there was an intention behind that where there is more going on behind the scenes. But this whole scene was, to me, proving to us that Torinaga is going along with a whole plan. It was showing that Torinaga's power is that he's just an incredible actor, right? Because
that's what I was getting at. So I agree with you. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Like, he's coming in here and he is pretending that he's not thinking about the future. He's like, oh, I don't have time for your shit because I'm thinking about is tomorrow. But she's thinking about the future too, and she knows that he is, because why else would she be bringing this proposal to him, asking for a stick of time and all this other stuff? So she is so smart, and she knows how smart Torinaga is. She breaks it down about the spy. Why would you leave your already weakened garrison so exposed? And he doesn't even come back. All he says is, oh, like, you assumed that I decimated my army with an earthquake. He doesn't really like say yes or no. And she's like, oh, you're right, I'm sorry, I must have misunderstood. But she was coming out there saying, I know you have a plan. And at the end, Torinaga's writing a will. I think that's why he throws her that land, because he's like, yeah, you know what? We are going to be around. She's going to be around. She has a good idea. So
let me ask you a question off the back of that, because I didn't even think of that angle. as much of him playing up Torinaga that is playing up everything he's doing in an acting fashion. Is there any world where his brother is in on this and this is all a plan?
Well, I honestly thought about that too, and I wanted to bring it up, but I thought it was too tinfoily. But nobody
died. Very interesting. Very interesting after when we get to the final scene.
Right.
No soldiers died, right? Like, he didn't send his... Saeki didn't send his army and kill any of Torinaga's soldiers. So I was also thinking, could they be putting on a show together? Mm-hmm. And by Nagakata being the naive person he is, he fucked up this plan by going in and killing his people before, and something he didn't even know about. I will say, I'm not 100% on that, but it definitely seems like it could be a possibility, knowing how smart Torinaga is. He could have been like, hey, dude, we're going to do this together.
We know as audience members that Nagakata is purposefully left out of all of Torinaga's schemings because he's just too immature. He's proven that every single episode. So that would track. Yeah. And I think that would clean up almost every complaint I had about Torinaga as a character. Are we too far reaching?
I don't think it's that tinfoily, Paul, because what you're saying makes a lot of sense. When I said the final scene's a problem, it's not a problem for the plan in a way with how it was written, because Nagakata went rogue. And to your point, Luke, Nagakata doesn't know Torinaga's plan. If Torinaga has a plan, maybe Hiramatsu knows, but otherwise, it's going to be Torinaga and his brother if his brother's part of this plan. And I want to apologize for everybody because he's Psycho, he's Psyche, Psycho, Seiki. So I think that it tracks, because tell me, just think, take a second to think, what other way can this make sense, or can a plan be made? Like, what other plan is there unless his brother's involved? I think we're all in agreement that we hope and we pray that he has a plan and it is all part of the plan, because that just seems like Torinaga.
Dartboard throw, as just playing devil's advocate, because I also believe there's nothing there, is the Portuguese and some sort of Catholic alliance, which I don't know how they're going to get around Kiyama and Ono's part in that, because they also
would never
are Catholic.
Be friends again with JB.
Oh yeah, JB would be thrown out the window, which could be why he's so cold to him all the time and not giving him a bone. But those are the only other established presence outside of Ishido and Ochiba that we know about. But I don't even, that was just off the top of the head. I haven't thought that one all the way through to actually believe it's a possibility. But
the one little tiny thing to add to that is the next scene we kind of get is Nagakata and Omi talking in the springs, just to jump ahead a little bit.
Yep.
And Saeki actually comes out, and he was eavesdropping the whole time, and he's like, none of this was easy for me, you know. This could be more of Saeki just going into the act, but, like, you know, he is my brother, he is family. And at the end, he says, death is not beautiful. It's just like a lonely path in the woods. And to me, that's kind of the same mindset as he doesn't want to fight and he doesn't want to kill anybody, right?
Wise, right?
And that's
To Torinaga. That's what you're going to say. Yeah, we're two peas, bro. This is the important quote of the episode, because it's when Nagakata says, we're going to die, we're going to die beautifully. And Seiki is like, there's no beautiful death really, bro. You're going to have to grow up a little bit. And that's where he's in line with Torinaga. I didn't know if this was going to be a scene where Seiki, like, really turned heel and was going to kill Nagakata.
I thought it's the same. I literally said the same thing out loud to Alki and
he
Dave
was
when
talking
we were
watching.
Shit. I was like, did they just die?
Yeah, spineless
when
pig.
When he's talking shit and then Seiki comes out, I was like, oh, man. Is he going to kill him right here?
Right? And then there was another weird bathing scene that happened right before that, where Yabu just gets all butt-ass naked and bathes with the enemy. But there wasn't any words there to dissect. But just the hot springs stole the show this episode.
You want to talk about what was the point of this scene? Somebody please explain to me Yabu saying, oh, there's not enough water to share, and stripping and getting in there and then chuckling. That was the whole scene. I was like,
well, I mean, he literally pretends to draw his sword. So then they get all like, oh, what are you going to do? And they draw their swords, and then he just like takes them off and gets butt ass naked and just gets in the spring. Right.
If it was to show the tension, then it worked.
Yeah.
I think that's what it was.
Okay, so we're actually almost done. We're making great time here. The next scene is going to be the one I mentioned earlier in the podcast where I thought it was one of the most laugh out loud funny parts of all of Shogun so far, is when they're on the beach. It's Yabu and JB, and Yabu's just talking to himself because he knows JB can't hear him. And then he's like, you know what? Let's use that sword. I want to teach you how to use it. And then John says, oh, this appears to be occurring. And he just like doesn't know what's happening. And he whips out the sword. He's holding it like a fencing sword. He gets his ass beat, obviously, but at the same time Buntaro is watching this all go down, and I think this is already after Omi planted that seed in his head at the dinner, where he's like, oh, like, watch JB and Mariko. So he's looking extra hard at him here, and he almost executes him, but then he lets him go. So this is just like that isolated beach setting. Anything else you guys wanted to bring up besides how funny it was?
Dude, Yabu is without a doubt the funniest character. He cracks me up, everything that you said. And then when John's on the ground and he hits the sword out of his hand again, Yabu laughs. Then John kind of chuckles along with him, and Yabu kicks him, and he's like, why are you laughing? And then, and then at the end, too, when Buntaro like storms away, Yabu looks at Johnny's like, if I wasn't here, you would have died. Like, you're welcome. Yeah. It's like, well, you started this. What the fuck are you talking about? He is money. I love him so much.
It's a great scene. Imagine being someone that can't understand Japanese and not knowing if this is a practice tutorial session or if he's actually trying to kill you. Right. And it was just hilarity.
So,
and we're going to get into the Buntaro stuff, so we can wait on that.
Yeah, one more scene.
High school drama shit.
That's a perfect spot for me to ask you guys this, though, because we've seen John kind of learning. This was earlier, like episode 3, episode 4. Mariko is trying to teach him Japanese and he's trying to learn. Do you think there's any chance that he has actually learned a little bit of Japanese because he's been asking Mariko less and less about, like, what is he saying? What is he saying? And he's going to straight out say,
he's gonna pull Daenerys.
He's just gonna converse in front of them and be like, hey, I kind of like picked up on this lately. Or do you really think he has no idea what Yabu's saying right here?
He definitely says things and he definitely understands certain things, and I think that part is to show us how much time is going by and how much he's learning throughout. I wouldn't be surprised if one of the, like, the big scenes towards the end, 8, 9, 10, whatever, when it matters, is that after all this time, he can now understand. I mean, he definitely has said a good amount in the last like 2 episodes.
Yeah.
He said, you're all going to die. And he, I mean, I know there's like the, you know, hello, how you doing, blah, 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 that kind of stuff. But there's been plenty of situations where he's saying things, and he, to me, sounds like he's saying it pretty good when he does say it. He doesn't sound like he's butchering it. I mean, certain times it's supposed to be a joke that he is, but other times when he's supposed to just be speaking with them, I think he's been doing pretty well. So, yeah, if he pulls a Daenerys, that'd be pretty badass.
The intro to the episode when Tornaga is introducing John to Saiki, and he's like, oh, you trained the barbarian. What John says right there, you know, seems like that was pretty flawless. And it seemed like Saiki was even really impressed by it, too. So,
yeah,
I don't know. Could
the only way in my head it works is if it's in episode 10, because if it's anything before that, it eliminates Mariko's purpose early. Yeah, and that her purpose is to be his translator. So, but that's it. I don't really have anything else to add. You guys covered it.
How cute would that be? He's like, I didn't even need a translator all this time, but I was pretending I to have you around. Oh, my God. We just figured it out.
Just starts ripping freaking poetic Japanese, just perfect grammar. That'd be amazing.
Fuck yeah.
This is the last little scene that we get before just we're going to close out the episode with a couple of bigger important scenes here. And I guess it's important in hindsight now because this is Nagakado's last talking scene where he goes up to Fuji, who's training and looking pretty bad with that. I didn't write down the name of the weapon. It's not a spear, obviously. Yeah. It's
Naginata.
Yes. So she's training with that, not looking too good. But her reason is like, if everybody needs a fight, we're going to basically be putting our lives on the lines here. But the important thing that Nagakado ends up saying is that he blames himself for Fuji's husband and child's death because he wasn't the brave one to stand up for his father all the way back in episode 1, which she doesn't blame him at all. She's a good person. Why would she blame him? I didn't take much from it. It was just that this was his last chance to really get a sort of redemption in his own head before he ends up going for Psyche's head and dying.
This scene to me, honestly, sheds some light on, I forget his name. The one who spoke out episode one, Fuji's
Todayoshi?
Late husband.
Todayoshi, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, nice. Todayoshi. It sheds some light on that other people actually respected him for doing it. Like, yeah. Nagakata was saying,
we called
like,
him a dumbass.
Yeah, like I wanted to do it. Like I couldn't bear the disrespect that my father was getting from these insults, but I wasn't brave enough. So In that fashion, I was thinking, why would this idiot say this if he knows this is going to be the outcome? But it does put a little bit more respect on everything.
Yeah, I really wrote idiot as his name on my tree, and I never thought we would have to care. I honestly didn't think we were going to have to care about Fuji much after episode one.
Yeah.
But that was a very incorrect assumption.
Hell yeah.
Let's not throw the shade on Fuji with her weapon, because Nagakata does say you shouldn't be practicing with this while you're still injured. So let's hope.
True.
My headcanon is going to be that she actually is very good with it and she's just injured. But
if she's trained with Madoko, then she's definitely going to be
pretty damn
good with it.
They sprinkled throughout this episode all the signs that Nagakata was going to do something rash.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get to it.
These next couple of scenes are just, well, I guess it's one big scene. It's just a couple of characters moving in and out. Is Torinaga going over his will that Paul already mentioned, giving Lady G her wishes, writing all that stuff down. And we have part one where Buntaro and Mariko have the conversation. Buntaro himself leaves the conversation, and then it's just a Torinaga and Mariko conversation. So whatever you guys want to bring up first, we can just take it like that.
Buntaro's so funny, man. He's so blinded by hatred that he's not thinking things through. Like, he came in here and was like, please let me take the barbarian's head before all this is over. Why? And he has to explain why. Because I think him and my wife has something going on. So you're going to kill your wife too? And he's like, no, I'm only asking for his head. So he's so... For being as stoic and like warrior mindset as he is, there's obviously a lot of thoughts going on in his head full of hatred. And we know he wanted to like kill John from the get-go, but now it's becoming like it's just boiling over. Like he's not even going to be able to control it one day. He's just going to fucking slice her. And it goes more into your point that he doesn't want Mariko to kill.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. That's what I was going to say.
He wants her to live. He's like, fuck, man, if I cut this off, she's literally just going to end it. So it's, you're completely right. Like you saw this from episode five that is now just coming to life for me. Buntaro really cares about her.
In a twisted way.
Yeah, in a twisted way. And yeah, I can't see it not being your original idea, Luke, because now we're getting into the high school drama bullshit that I don't know that I need in this show. Where does it go? A throwdown with Buntaro and JB eventually? Maybe it's a cool scene, but JB should lose that if we're being completely honest.
Oh, yeah.
I don't really understand the point except for like adding drama. I know that, oh, Buntaro, maybe he's going to be gone at some point because of whatever reason he dies. And now it frees up Mariko and JB to be together. And eventually they are going to be together. And yeah, we're happy. But I don't really see why I care about Buntaro. Right.
Yeah, I think it is for drama. It's exactly what you're saying. Like, it might be a super now even more emotional sacrifice knowing that Buntaro actually does care about Mariko and he's still going out and going to sacrifice his life, assuming he dies in some battle coming up. Honestly, I'm just saying I'm definitely willing to wait and see, and I feel like there is going to be an emotional payoff, but it's not it is drama if you want to look at it like that.
Yeah.
And on the flip side of the second part of this conversation, I feel like Mariko just regressed as a character, and it doesn't even feel believable of why she regressed. Nothing happened that took away all of her character development she's been building up through six episodes, that she's now just telling Torinaga, I've been loyal to you, but also like, please grant my wish and you be the one that grants my ability to kill myself. Right. Like that all happens here because she's not saying anything about JB. And she's not telling Buntaro she's wrong, because in the first part of the conversation, she says, my life is my husband's to take. So it's not like she's pushing back on anything. I'm just confused because this is like the lowest I've felt about Mariko since episode one or two.
So I thought that what was going to happen in this scene was going to be a big emotional scene where Torunaga says, what is between you and the engine, right? What's going on? Okay, I guessed it right before the earthquake. You guys were bangity banging, all right? I know what's good. Tell me what's good, right? I thought that when she like started to look really upset and said, please, what happens right before that is he says, me or JB. I thought her thing was going to be, please don't make me choose, right? Mm-hmm. I thought it was going to be something crazy like that, where that's very dishonorable and against her character, but she does love JB. Coming from the scene in episode 6 where she's very upset with the Willow World scene, I thought her saying, please don't make me choose, was coming. And instead, we get, please allow me to take my life. And I brought this up in the intro. Like, you just put her in the back burner for most of the episode. She's our girl. We want her in the very front. And not only do you put her in the back burner, but when she does come to the front lines here, like you said, look at character regression. I don't understand how that conversation that she has with Torunaga in episode 6 didn't give her the purpose to say, I'm going to live.
Right. There's no explanation there for me.
I do. You guys keep saying the character regression, and I get what you're saying. And in a sense, I do think she did kind of mentally regress, right? Because everything was happy when it was just her and John. And then Buntaro came back, and that's when everything really sets in, because she has all that come flooding back, and she is at her low point, right? She did sleep with John, being a married woman to Buntaro, like, didn't know she was still married at the time, but looking back on it, she's in her head, she might actually be like, oh my God, I did cheat. I am dishonorable. Like, I'm not a good person. Like, maybe she is having those thoughts. So one, maybe she is going back to the every breath and every minute waiting alive is feels like drowning, because she is in a mentally low point. But also, she could have brought this up now just to deflect what Jimmy, I think you were kind of touching on this. When Torunaga comes up, he says, like,
yeah,
you're confusing your priorities. You got to choose. Are you with me or are you with the barbarian? And does he say barbarian there?
I was actually going to ask you that.
I think he does. This is the most emotional he's ever been, like, in an uncalculated way. So I think he was just freaking out, and like everything's coming crumbling down. All of his advisors are having their own strifes that he has bigger things to worry about. So I think it just bubbled up. But yeah, he definitely was shitting on John a little bit in the way he was talking about him here.
Definitely. And she just, instead of answering that question, just pulls out the knife and says, please end it. And he just knocks it away. Says, not today.
No, I think you make some good points about the mental regression being tied to Buntaro's return. It's just bothering me that it was such a good conversation that Torunaga had with her. Like, almost just take that out and everything kind of makes sense.
I agree. I don't know. Like, what? In episode 8, is she just going to be like, I'm going to follow my father's purpose again? I don't know why you have that conversation. Unless, Paul, you're right, and she is just deflecting. Because he says, pick one right now, pick one. And then she gives an emotional answer that distracts Torunaga.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you explain that to us?
Yeah,
I mean, I'm sure you can, but you're going to have to explain it to us in the next episode.
Okay, we got two more scenes here, and then this is the episode. So the next, I don't know if it's the next day or whatever it is, later that day, Torunaga holds political counsel, and his brother comes, and he gives his decision. Nobody knows what he's going to say. Everybody thinks he's got plans and plans, like all of his advisors. This came completely unexpected to all them when he says that he's going to give into Ishida's order and go back to Osaka to face his judgment. And right away, JB's the only one that gets up. He's like, what the hell is wrong with all of you? You're all dead. Yeah. Fuck Crimson Sky. And he walks out, which, Jimmy, you brought up a good point that you were texting me, or maybe it was Lansing on somebody on Discord could have mentioned it as well, but we just talked about Todoyoshi getting killed for doing something like that to Ishida. Why would John not instantly be put to death as well?
I was worried something was going to happen.
So I think the big thing for Todoyoshi was that he spoke against a regent for Torunaga almost. So it was like, you
insulting on his behalf?
Like he's insulting the regent on Torunaga's behalf, and Torunaga saying, you know, whatever he said in episode 1, like, how dare you imply that they're being dishonorable to me or whatever. But either way, it is an outburst, and we don't get the immediate answer to that. Like, we don't see what they're going to do to him yet. But yeah, I mean, he literally says, "You guys are all dumbasses. You're all going to freaking die." And he rolls out.
Yeah.
I'm surprised the brother didn't stop him. I don't know. I don't know what I expected.
More intense. I feel like if John insulted Saeki, the brother,
right,
then he would have been, yeah, go, gotcha, yeah, kill yourself right now. So, but yeah, I was like, man, ballsy. And I know Marco told John, like, he surrendered, but she didn't really translate a whole lot. And he kind of got up and he understood the whole vibe. So,
yeah.
I was like, were you catching on to more than, like, you were leading?
You love this hidden Japanese speaking ability.
Hey, he says you're all dead in Japanese to them.
Yeah, but it was funny because he's saying, "Behold, like, the brilliant master of trickery." He's making fun of him, but I feel like he is tricking everybody. Like, this could be the big play. So
we hope
John's just making himself look
stupid. That's our hope, man. That is our hope.
Make us look dumb as podcasters.
Yeah.
For doubting him for even 1 second.
Crimson fucking horse shit is the last line that John walks away.
Yeah. Any other comments for that scene? Because we're about to roll into Nagakato's death, if not.
Just that he's going to be the escort all the way to Osaka gates. So
yeah,
it could be the escort. And all of a sudden you get to the gates and he's not an escort anymore.
And it's Crimson Sky.
And he's an ally.
I mean, you can Crimson Sky from a feint when it's the, you know, they're showing up with their entire army thinking they're bringing Torinaga as a hostage or whatever, and then you just storm. But
I mean, the only way they're winning this
is
trickery.
JB, you got to get our boy in on this.
Yeah. Yeah. The only way they're winning this is trickery. Like, they're not going to, like, outman.
And Rodriguez.
I would be
Roddy's
so
Roddy's
got
to be back, man. He's got to be back.
He pulls up to the final fight, and all of a sudden he's manning cannons and shooting down the fort walls. Oh, my God, I would lose.
Dude, I can't wait until there's two different ships on the water, and JB and Roddy look at each other, and they say some crazy-ass shit, insulting each other.
Fuck your mother.
Smiling.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take it home. We've been hinting at it throughout this entire episode. We honestly talked through most of it already, but the entire tea house scene where Kiku lets Nagakato in and he is about to execute Torinaga's brother, but ends up slipping on a rock and bleeding out in the yard. So
it
was it good for you guys? Was it surprising? Because I was like jaw on the floor, did not expect it to happen right there. I thought he had a shot of getting his first kill, if that is truly his first kill.
Nagakato is so incompetent. You can't kill Saiki when he's no sword, no weapon. All of your men come in and you're attacking him and you slip and fall and die. He had him.
You can't even do
that right. You got a problem, bro.
It was painful. So I don't think he slipped on the rock. I think he slipped on the long tails of Saiki's robe or gown. I don't know the proper name for it.
I thought you were like going with some kind of joke. Like,
no,
like, it's long.
No, I genuinely think that's what happened, because even before that, when Kiku leaves, she's like, "Ooh, I got some fun tools. Let me go get them." Which, yeah, we can go more into that. Like, what's going to happen with her? Did she let everybody in? Was that just good timing? But anyway, Saiki goes to grab
the tools. Is it, Paul?
The robe. Oh, you don't want to know. You're not. Don't ask. You're not ready. But he puts
you're older.
He puts on the robe, and the camera focuses on the bottom of it and how bunched up it is. And I don't know if there was like more of a meaning behind that. Like he shouldn't have had that robe in the first place because it didn't fit him properly or whatever, but they showed that a little bit. And then at the very end, I think Nagakato actually does slip on that. And that's what does him in. I don't know what meaning that could possibly have though.
Still pathetic.
Oh,
either
terrible.
Way.
Terrible.
It's just a rash decision from one of the worst characters in the show. You feel bad for the guy, maybe, but
not really.
I mean, you had him. If that's your plan, I'm not saying it's a good plan. I don't know what happens to the army if all of a sudden their leader is assassinated. I really don't know how that works. You know, if number two just shows up and is like, "Well, now I'm going to be the the person escorting you to Ornaga. You did nothing. You killed five guys. We have 5,000, whatever. I don't know. But the fact that he, you know, rolls in like that, guy is just got done getting a belt around his neck or whatever during sex, Johnny Drama style. Yeah. And he puts this robe on that you're talking about, Paul, and then he gets attacked. And these guys had the element of surprise, no weapons, and you still can't take him out. It's a damn shame for Nagakato. And it's a interesting question that you asked, Paul. Did Kiku let them in? Was it great timing? Did Lady G think that this is the plan? I mean, if Kiku's involved, I know maybe culturally this dishonors the Coruscants and everything. Like if you turn one into an assassin when she's not supposed to be an assassin or something. Like I don't know any of that kind of stuff, but tell Kiku to pull on that freaking belt a little bit harder or something. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it just seems like a shitty plan if Kiku is involved because now she is dead. He's alive. He thinks either way that she let them in, so she's going to be dead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. My question is, like, how'd she even know? It seems like she was really in on it. Like, we're not 100%, but the way that she was like, let me go get something, I'll be right back, and everything happens, makes it seem like she really is. And did Omi talk to Lady G, Gin, and Omi talked to Nagakato, and then Omi talked to Kiku, and that's how the Nagakato and Kiku set it up? Because, like, it seems like they need a middleman. Nagakato wouldn't go directly to Kiku and be like, hey, let's do this. So I wonder if there was more to the setup than let on, like Omi was actually really involved. But yeah, like, what would have happened if they did it and Saiki was actually on our good side, like we were talking about?
Yeah.
That would have been terrible. But then just to go against that argument, why wouldn't Saiki say right there to Nagakato, hey, I'm actually working with your dad. This is all a ruse. That would be my biggest argument against it.
That could have been the bad scene, like earlier.
True.
Either way, I feel like if you make a deal or some kind of agreement with Toranaga, we talk about honor and all this stuff throughout this entire season. I just think that if they say to each other, we're not going to tell anybody else, just because you're alone with Nagakato or even about to get killed, doesn't mean necessarily that he would say, hey, man, I'm part of this. Don't kill me. I mean, it all is happening fast, too. So I don't know. But the thing that we have here now is two scenarios. One is that, Paul, you're right, and Saiki is a part of this plan, and that's the grand plan. And Toranaga is going to be like, Jesus, Nagakato just died for no reason. Or Saiki's not part of the plan. Maybe Toranaga was actually going to surrender himself, and now he gets a fire lit under his ass because his son is killed. I don't know if that's really... I feel like he would just be like, my son was dumb.
Yeah,
I feel like he would just be like, my son was dumb and rash. He shouldn't have done that. And he'll be upset, but not... So I don't know.
And had toddler feet. Well, yeah, man. And I definitely think that affects everybody's view on this episode, right? Is because the last thing we see is Nagakata smash his head. And we're like, damn, really? Like, out of all the ways that we were talking about,
I mean, that's how poetic, though.
It is.
For him, that's all he wanted was to do something crazy for the storybooks. And what happens? He slips and he falls and he hits his head and he bleeds out. And just like Seiki says, nothing beautiful about that.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. What a way to end.
That's the freaking episode. And I said I was going to do this on the last podcast, this podcast, Jimmy, for you, because we're not getting out of here without putting you through the ringer of having a way harder time to decide your top four favorite characters, because this episode probably would have changed my list from episode six coverage. So before we get out of here, just what's your gut reaction? How are we feeling? Give me your top four favorite characters.
So as of last week, you asked me, and Toranaga number one, JB number two. I don't think that's changed for me, even though JB didn't get to do that much this episode. My number three was Mariko. And my number four was Oshiba. I thought she killed it in what she's been doing so far. Fuji and her are just fighting. I don't know if it was recency bias of last week, but I had Oshiba as number four when you asked me last week. Mm-hmm. Let's do some more recency bias and take Oshiba out for now because she didn't really get anything to do this episode. I'm still going Mariko number three because I have faith that she's going to end up being fine. I'm not happy with her direction, but I think she's going to be fine. And everything she's done so far, I love her. I think I'm going to put Yabu in and slide him into number four.
Great answer. That's a good answer.
Slide him into number four.
Love it.
And let me also, while we're here, I talked about Oshiba for a second. I want to throw something at you. I threw it at Luke last week. And really quick, let me jump on the YouTube channel because someone ruined it for me. I was going to bring it up last episode because you know that I'm Theory Town and that's all I love to do. I wanted to throw this theory at you guys. Don't know if it matters. Don't know if it's even a thing, but Steel 803254 commented on our YouTube channel at Binstown TV podcast saying Lady Oshiba was impregnated by someone else. The Taiko was sterile. At least that's what I got from the whole hundreds of tried scene. My theory that I wanted to bring up was that, yes, the Taiko was sterile. He couldn't have kids. Hundreds have tried. And Lady Oshiba says, F fate. And she decides on herself to get impregnated somehow by anybody else. Doesn't have to be a character in the show. Literally, just get impregnated. It's a huge risk to her because if she's caught sleeping with someone else while she's trying to have the heir for the Taiko, she's dead. But if she succeeds, the entire status that she has right now is what she was aiming for.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's just going to be like, I mean, it could be like a, hey, I'm going to reveal this as a side note. I can't see how it's like a huge thing for the show, but I feel like it would be cool for her character just to show more so that she's saying, screw fate. I'm going to go from wherever I am to even higher. I mean, we talked about how, you know, it's not like her status was low or anything. She was the previous ruler's daughter. But, you know, being the person who has the heir for the Taiko, it changes her whole status. It changes her whole name, right? I mean, and she wanted that for herself. She decides, I'm going to take it.
Mm-hmm. And it would make sense if that was the play, because then she cares less about the last Taiko's warnings and how he wanted to run things. She just wants the power. She wants the ownership of the dynasty of the future heirs. So that could work. But I also think Paul brought it up on the podcast that the last Taiko's actual wife was giving her all these herbs that maybe she was implying was messing with her body. And that could have been what she was hinting at when she said that I put my body through so much. But I also do that, like the idea of the reverse flip pregnancy, because that's just fun politics.
Yeah. Right. Not actually his son.
Yeah.
Love. That would be crazy.
Born of blonde hair.
No. Kind of, yeah. It always fucking comes back, man.
Yeah, for real. All right, that's about it. Jay Spain, you can take us home.
All right, guys, anything else? No theories, no nothing. We're good. We're going to wait till next week. Shogun's not today. It was yesterday when we watched it. It wasn't last week either because I wasn't on the pod, but it'll be next Tuesday. All right, guys, if you like what you heard, check us out at BingeTownTV.com. Like I said earlier in the intro, we love talking to all of you. If you want to join the Discord, that link is in the description, or you can hit us up on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok. Any of it will answer as long as we can see it. If you hit us up enough, we definitely will see it. We answer everybody we can. If you're new to the podcast, we cover so many different shows. All you have to do, check us out, BingeTownTV.com, or subscribe at BingeTownTV on any of your favorite podcast apps. Once again, we are Binstown TV. We have three episodes left. We can't wait. Thank you so much for listening.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.